Good afternoon and welcome to our committee.
Madam
State
Chair.
State your name for the committee.
Members of the committee, my name is Jack Geller. I'm president of the Center for Rural Policy and Development in St. Peter, Minnesota. And it really is my pleasure to once again address this committee. I've been asked to come today to talk a little bit about rural health care, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk a little bit about rural health care. There are those who are far more expert about it than I am, but today happens to be the day that we're releasing the Rural Minnesota Journal, or I should say the most recent issue of the Rural Minnesota Journal, which all of you have. There are some extra copies on the rail, and I'm pleased to say that hopefully when you get back to your offices, you will all have one in your mailbox. At least if my lugging them all around this building over the past hour or two played some role, you should have a copy in your mailbox. As with other issues of the journal, they're all thematic, and this one really focuses on just health care in rural Minnesota, and I'm not going to go through a whole variety and try to kind of deal with the depth that the journal has, but I will say that the journal is a compilation of articles written by experts in state government, at the University of Minnesota, practitioners that are in practice, and one really poignant article by a fourth-year medical student who is about to embark on her residency program and her career, having chosen to become a rural family physician. And so we asked her to write at a very first-person, personal level about why rural practice and why family medicine. And I think you'll enjoy that as well. As a disclaimer, I think it's important for me to say up front and for you to realize that the expertise around these articles lie with the researchers and the authors that wrote them, not with me and not with the center. As an information generator and an information broker, the center is there to compile this type of information and ensure that U.S. policymakers and decision makers are getting good, accurate information. But again, the expertise lies with these experts and not with the center. As you go through this volume at your leisure, I'm pleased to also say, without much reservation, that most, if not all, of these experts are pretty much at your disposal. As you go through this, whether it's dealing with Minnesota Care or health insurance or emergency medical services or the plight of rural pharmacies or whatever it might be, if you feel that that expertise is important to you, these people will be more than happy to come and talk with you about that. I also know that health insurance in particular is a big issue. And there are many ideas that are floating around this building dealing with expanding Minnesota Care, changing different definitions, and so forth. So I want to just make a few remarks about that, and particularly how these things play out in rural Minnesota. There is, and has been for quite a while, a higher percentage of uninsured Minnesotans in rural Minnesota than in the metro area. But it is slight now in terms of that gap. Roughly 8% in the metro area and roughly 9.1% in rural Minnesota. However, it's important to understand that the percentage of uninsured in Minnesota, both rural and urban, are growing. The University of Minnesota reports that in 2001, in the metro area, 5.9% of metro area residents were uninsured. In 2004, it increased to 8%. In rural Minnesota, those comparable numbers are 8.3% uninsured in rural areas in 2001, and it increased to 9.1%. So obviously, this gap in uninsurance between rural areas and urban areas is narrowing. But almost all of that narrowing is due to the accelerated rate of uninsurance in the metro area. And almost all of that acceleration is due to the loss of group insurance, not changes in public health insurance or the changes in people purchasing individual policies. In the metro area in 2001, 79.8% of residents had their insurance through some type of group insurance. In 2004, that went down in the metro area to 73.8. That's a fairly significant drop. And while there's been a similar drop in rural areas, it really hasn't been as steep. And so actually, the uninsurance gap between rural and urban has actually narrowed, but not for a good reason. The use of public insurance, such as Minnesota Care, Medicaid, other kind of public mechanisms, has been growing in both rural and metro areas. And in terms of the purchase of individual coverage, it's been fairly stable over that period of time. It really hasn't changed that much. It's important to understand how people are insured as well. In the metro area, there's a greater reliance on group coverage as a greater percentage of employers in the metro area provide such coverage for their employees. This is likely due to the larger size companies that the metro area has. Small businesses and self-employed individuals is what the rural economy is made of. And these are some of the groups that have the hardest time securing affordable health insurance for their employees. Consequently, unlike the metro area, in rural Minnesota, there's a much greater reliance on public insurance than there is in the metro area. In 2004, the University of Minnesota reported that 18.6% of rural Minnesotans participated in some type of public insurance program. That number in the metro area was 13.9%. And so while the actual gap and the difference in the number of people who are uninsured in both rural and metro is kind of narrowing, it's important to understand that there's a very different mix of how people are insured, whether it be through some kind of group insurance, whether it's through purchasing individual coverage, or through some kind of public program. Let me also just say a couple of words about Minnesota Care. Minnesota Care obviously was not designed as a rural health program. It was designed to provide coverage for children and lower-income working families who cannot secure private insurance through their employer. But as Julie Sonier, who is an employee in the Health Economics Department at the Minnesota Department of Health, points out in her article, and I should say all these statistics that I'm citing come straight out of the journal, and so no need to have to worry about if you don't write them down, you're going to lose them. As she points out, understand when you're dealing with issues of health insurance, you're primarily concerned about the non-elderly part of our demographic, because almost all of our elderly have Medicare coverage. When you look at metro areas, our urban counties, if you will, they contain 73.9% of all non-elderly Minnesotans. And yet, they only contain, these same counties, 60.7% of all Minnesota Care enrollees. On the other hand, rural counties contain only 26.1% of all non-elderly Minnesotans. And yet, they comprise 39.3% of all Minnesota Care enrollees. So obviously, even though Minnesota Care wasn't designed as a rural health program, and we don't even really think of it as a rural health program, The reality is that Minnesota Care has become a very important path to health insurance for people who live in rural Minnesota. My point is just simple and somewhat straightforward. As you explore changes in Minnesota Care and other public health programs for that matter, please pay attention to how these changes will play out in rural Minnesota. And if we can somehow help you work through that, or if some of the experts who wrote these articles can help you work through that, that would be our privilege and pleasure. Again, while Minnesota Care was not designed to be a rural health program, in many ways it has become one of the most important paths to health insurance coverage for many rural children and their families. Lastly, I invite you to scrutinize and seriously review all the articles in this latest issue of the journal. I somehow do it injustice by just talking about the issues of health insurance and Minnesota Care. While they're important, there are a lot of rural health issues in this journal. Whether we're talking about emergency medical services, and as you got to understand that as the rural health workforce, you know, has significantly greater health professional shortage areas and in some areas significant access barriers, our emergency medical services system even takes on a heightened level of importance. If you get into a traffic accident on 35E on the way home, you know, there's a pretty good chance that an ambulance is going to be there within a matter of minutes from the time of that accident. But as you know, in many rural places, it could be a while before somebody's been able to figure out there's been an accident and even call it in. And of course, if you have serious acute health issues, oftentimes the EMS personnel really need to be trained and get you not only to the closest facility, but to the closest appropriate facility. There are also important discussions in this issue dealing with the loss of our independent rural pharmacies. We oftentimes take that pharmacy on the corner for granted until, of course, it's no longer there. And we're seeing a very steady decline in the number of rural pharmacies that are basically disappearing across rural Minnesota. And, of course, one of the most important issues that I even have a hard time getting my hands around, but fortunately, Larray Knatterud, who wrote a really good issue or an article in this issue, she's with the Department of Human Services, talks about what I would call, she doesn't use this term, but I would call the looming long-term care crisis in rural Minnesota. We already have a disproportionately high percentage of elderly people in rural Minnesota. Our state demographer, and you know, we hear all the time, we're just a short time away from the first wave of the baby boomers retiring. The truth of the matter is rural Minnesota represents the leading edge of this demographic change. And there are real questions as to whether or not our rural communities, our rural health service providers, our rural human service providers are really prepared for this change and taking care of this elderly population. So I guess with that, I will close, certainly try to address any questions you may have, but I guess my message is when you have some time, maybe there'll be another big snowstorm and you'll have the opportunity to sit down and comfortably read some of the articles. Because certainly if you come from rural Minnesota, you will read a lot which you see every day on your main street and in your community. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Geller. Representative Doty?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can see, I walked in a few minutes late, and maybe I missed this, but the definition of rural that you're using here, is that non-metro counties, or is it U.S. Census 2,500 and less, or...
Madam Chair, Representative, it varies a little bit from article to article depending upon the particular author, but I think it's fair to say that in the majority of cases, the unit of analysis is at the county level, and it generally breaks out to metropolitan and non-metropolitan counties. Those that have MSAs are thought of as metropolitan statistical areas and those that are not.
So, Madam Chair, that would mean 2,500 or less, usually the same numbers that U.S. Census officially says is urban, as I understand it.
Madam Chair, Representative, no. By and large, the unit is the county. So basically, it would be all of Minnesota with the exception of seven-county metro area, Rochester, Duluth, and those MSA counties.
And one more. Madam Chair, is there a further breakdown in here then of farm as opposed to simply just rural? Will there be any way, or is there a source somewhere that breaks it down to that level?
Dr. Geller?
Madam Chair, Representative, there is that, and if there's one regret, that's it, because as you will discuss shortly after I exit, some of the issues regarding farmers and access to health insurance and a variety of issues because of the unique way they're dealing with very unique businesses that are capital intensive, asset rich, oftentimes income, and assets don't quite match up. But to be honest and truthful, no, we don't address that. I can certainly bring to your attention various different resources other than this that address that directly.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Comments? Thank you. This was kind of the premiere of the journal, and I appreciate you doing that. I know people were waiting for this information for a while, so I appreciate you coming and sharing. And I think as a teacher, we will be tested on this book. Whoever gets the highest scores.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And if you need extra copies, they're available. And I should say, for those in the audience as well, all the information is on our website, www.ruralmn.org. It's all free and available. You could download a particular article. You can download the entire volume as well.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, would you like to come in and talk to us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as a former teacher, you remember I used to tutor your daughter occasionally.
Yep, thank you. I tell that story all the time.
Did she make it?
Yeah, she's in college. She's doing fine.
You
and she's at St. Ben's. Hosh wanted to.
Oh, she didn't make it then.
No, she's doing great. I'm sure all those math tutoring, it was great. I should explain it. When my daughter was here, when she was a fifth and sixth grader, I homeschooled her, and I picked out legislators throughout who were in the House, and I chose Speaker Swigum to tutor Elizabeth. So every Wednesday he came to our office and made sure she was on track.
On mathematics. I could only handle the math. More history than the rest of you know, but Mr. Hosh, that little comment about St. Ben's, I apologize. Although the ball game didn't go very good this weekend. Huh?
It makes it all that more fun. Brand new rival.
Madam Chair and members, I have a quick and simple bill before you, one that passed this body, this House, last year when Representative Pawlowski carried the bill. When I was a speaker for a few years, I made it a point never to carry any legislation. So Gene carried this piece of legislation, passed it quickly and easily through the House. It did pass out of the Senate last year, two members, but unfortunately it passed the last day of the legislative session. We didn't have time to get a bill back to the House and back to the Senate at the end of the session. Senator Murphy did pass the bill last year. He has already passed it this year, and it has passed the Senate body on a 63-0 vote about a month ago today. Members, the bill is...
Mr. Speaker, we're going to have...
Yep.
Representative Heidrichen move the bill for you.
I move that Senate File 138 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And sorry for getting ahead of
no,
the,
that was great.
A little bit. Madam Speaker, Madam Chair, members, a simple bill that basically provides that the Commissioners of Agriculture and Health shall get together, shall consult, shall meet, shall do some investigation, evaluate the problems that might be existing with some potential hazardous plants out there that are sold for retail, and you and I and certainly our livestock don't always know what those hazardous potential plants are and what the consequences of those plants may be. They would get together, evaluate, and give a report back to the legislature next year after including the stakeholders on how we can identify and make sure that consumers, farmers, I guess it doesn't help cattle very much. We have to kind of make the decisions for them, but are aware of the potential consequences of these potential plants. I did have a constituent myself, Madam Chair, who is with me today, Bob Marg over here. Bob, if you would come up, who had lost a couple of cattle. Bob is actually the person who has initiated this legislation through Mr. Pawlowski last year and myself now because of a hazardous plant that he had disposed of. As he disposed of it, I think the cattle ate it before you could get finally rid of it is what took place, and lost a couple of cows. Madam Chair, if you would not mind, Bob Marg from Winona County.
Thank you. Bob, would you state your name for the committee, please? Thank you.
Bob Marg from Elkhart, Minnesota.
Can you spell your last name for us?
M-A-R-G.
Okay. Thank you.
Go
Thank
ahead.
You.
Okay. I initiated this bill because I had some Japanese yew that we had planted around our house. And at the time we bought it, there was no label or anything on it that said it was poisonous. And when it started getting too big against the house and stuff, the boss told me I had to cut it down and haul it out to the burn pile. But we happened to pasture cattle around the burn pile, and that year it happened to be so dry we couldn't burn stuff. So it laid out there and it dried, and when my cattle pastured around it, I had two heifers, actually. One was milking about 3 months and one about 2 weeks, that decided they must taste good, and they ate about an 8-inch twig of it. And one died within about a half hour from when we put them out there, and the other one lasted about a day. And when the second one died, I finally got the vet out, which cost me a couple hundred dollars besides to try to figure out what happened or what it was. And when he cut them open, he says, "Is this Japanese yew?" And I didn't have a clue. But he went and investigated, and yes, it was. And he says it's one of the most poisonous plants there is. It's the first one they study in vet school. And he says they have nothing as an antidote. If you'd see the animal eat it, there's nothing you could do. And it will kill with some cows or some animals, because it will kill deer, dogs, whatever, people, if they eat it, within 5 minutes to 48 hours on a cow. When I testified to the Senate this year, Senator Sharon Ropes, who happens to be a master gardener, didn't even know how poisonous this plant was. And I just felt it was important. I went to the horticulture industry at the state fair 2 years in a row and asked them if there's any way they could label it or, you know, something to inform the public of how poisonous some of these plants were, because it isn't just Japanese yew. I've been told there's almost 120 plants that have some degree of poisonous. The first response I got was, "It's not the law, we don't have to." And the next year, the response I got was, "Well, if we label it as poisonous, people aren't going to buy it." But I do believe it is important for people to know. And since that point, I talked to my aunt who lives in Winona, and a lady next door started a daycare. And they found she had one of these real beautiful bleeding heart bushes with the flowers all on. And she was digging it out. And went over to ask what was the problem with it or what, and she says, "I can't have it. If you have daycare kids, you cannot have bleeding hearts in your yard." And I think it's just as important for my kids not to eat it as daycare kids. I mean, I had six kids, and all of them are grown up now, except the last one's 16, but he probably won't eat it anymore, but I've got grandkids now that are 2 years old that maybe would eat it. We also had that growing next to the house. So that's, you know, basically why I thought it should be something done. And what I actually was looking for was a label or something on the plants when you buy them. I mean, they can have everything else on the label, where to plant it, how to fertilize it, how to water it, you know, what sunlight it needs and everything else. Why couldn't they have a little label on that it's poisonous? I mean, I know some of these plants are only poisonous to certain things. Vet told me there's a certain lily. Anything can eat it except for cats. If cats eat it, it will kill them, and it don't take much of it. And I don't know how exactly to do it or what, but I figured that between the ag department and stuff, they should be able to figure something out on it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'll just add that when Representative Pawlowski and Bob first called me 3 years ago maybe about this problem, I thought Japanese yew was a new type of sheep maybe that was out there in the spring. And I've become a little bit more knowledgeable since then about the plants. But there's a number of toxic plants that I think maybe we should make consumers aware of.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Comments? If not...
We renew my motion to pass Senate File 138 and pass it on to the Finance Committee.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What we got to do is we got to be able to teach them. Right? Yeah, can do a good job.
Representative Otremba, would you like to move your bill before the committee, please?
I move that House File 276 before the committee with recommendation to pass to be referred to Finance Committee.
Thank you. Representative Otremba, please explain your bill.
I think my notepad's up there.
This is mine. That is not.
It's right there. Thank you. Well, Jack Geller coming was kind of a nice segue into my bill. My bill is it is Minnesota Care definition of income. I've been working on this bill, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years, trying to expand the number of family farmers that qualify for Minnesota Care. Under current federal law, farmers can use the value of depreciated assets and losses to offset their income when calculating gross income, which is a Schedule F. And many of you who are farmers know what a Schedule F is, and I think we've put one in each of your folders. But basically, it's a Form 1040 that calculates gross income for farmers. Under current law, only the losses are permitted to take toward their gross income. So adding back the depreciation would actually help them be qualifying for Minnesota Care. So I have some testifiers, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair.
That would be great. Good afternoon, Mr. Peterson. Would you please state your name and who you represent for the tape, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. To be very brief today, we do support House File 276 and appreciate the work Representative Otremba has done on this bill over the years. We have had good luck in the Senate in this bill the last couple of years. It's been in their omnibus bill, and it's moving through the process well over there again this year. This issue arose a couple of years ago with a constituent and a member of ours in what is now Representative Doty's district, and we've heard more and more about this bill, and I always think it's interesting, this issue on Minnesota Care. This isn't something that, people are always proud to come up and say, I'm on Minnesota Care, and it's, Mr. Chairman, you live in the same district I do, and when I first heard about this bill was at our feed mill in Grafton, where the farmers kind of sit around on Saturdays, about 10, 15 of them, and they like to give me some grief when I come in there on Saturdays to buy feed, and they'll say, what are you working on? And I'll say, well, I'm working on, health care and whatever. But this day I said we're working on Minnesota Care. It was this bill maybe 2 years ago. And a guy I've known most of my life, he's about my age. He has two daughters, and he's taken over his dairy farm from his daddy. He followed me out to my truck, and he said, you know, this Minnesota Care thing, he said, I had a problem. I was on it, and they refigured my income. I got kicked off of it, and I didn't qualify for it anymore because of this depreciation. But he didn't want to say in front of the whole group in there that he was on Minnesota Care. And I just think that's always an interesting point. We remember that what Mr. Geller was saying, there are a lot of Minnesotans on Minnesota Care. And this piece is something that as we talk more and more to people, especially dairy farmers, it seems that this is an issue. I'd also be really clear that, as the Ag Committee, we hope that many of you are, it's a good bipartisan effort, are also advocates of this bill as it hopefully goes forward. And that depreciation is it's real for farmers, okay? So when you're talking about buildings, machinery, are the two biggies, but you can also use it for breeding livestock, and you can also use it for perennial plants or planting, which I think is interesting. I don't know how people use that or what they characterize, but when I talk to our farmers, they tell us that depreciation is real, and especially if they're going to take an accelerated type depreciation, which we're also debating in the tax committee. I think Representative Brown's on that committee. Those are real, and they really do help farmers, and they do, affect what's going to happen. So I urge your consideration and support, but I also urge your advocacy for this bill as it goes forward to help rural Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Do you have any other testifiers?
Yes.
Thank you for coming. Please state your name and give us your testimony.
Yep. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Bob LaFave. I'm the Executive Director with the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. First, would just like to start off by thanking Representative Otremba for authoring House File 276 and to share with you that Minnesota Milk does definitely support the measure and ask for your support as well. The issue of healthcare accessibility and affordability has long been an issue with dairy producers. But it recently, and in fact over the course of the last year, rose to the top from our membership polling and from our forums and so on and so forth, asking our members what's important to them. Healthcare accessibility and affordability was number one. And that's why we're here today. We understand that, this isn't going to necessarily solve all the challenges that are facing dairy producers or rural Minnesota and the issue of healthcare accessibility and affordability, but it certainly will make health insurance, Minnesota Care, more accessible for farmers, in particular for dairy farmers, and especially our smaller farms. To give you an example, on average, roughly, you can expect that the dairy producer's their net income is going to be around $500 a cow, give or take, year in, year out. And a dairy producer milking 50 cows will have a net income of $25,000. Not very much to live on. Also considering that I know I've had several members come up to me, some paying as high as $1,500 a month, or over $1,500 a month for their health insurance. I just got off the phone here a few minutes ago with a dairy producer $3,000 deductible, and he's paying over $500 a month for his insurance. So it certainly is an issue. Again, as I'd just like to state that this will certainly have a benefit for our smaller dairy producers on limited income. It will also help those that are perhaps nearing that retirement age, you know, that our dairy producers, we have the age, average age continues to climb. And this will allow them to stay in the dairy business for a little while longer anyway, without having to eat into their equity in their dairies, all the while making health insurance more accessible. So we do urge your support for House File 276. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for either the testifiers, any of the testifiers?
Thank
you. Not, do you have anything further, Representative Otremba?
Wait, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. We think that there will be 20 to 25 additional families and about 100 additional adults without children that will qualify. About 1,300 families in the first year and about 1,000 families in future years. Another 875 adults without children in first and future years. So they seem to be not big numbers, but it's really big numbers for our average farmers that are working hard. And like someone said, they have a lot of assets, but not a lot of cash flow. So I would appreciate your support. And also, you're in other committees, and it will come to other committees. Make sure you talk to your colleagues so that we can do just some little piece on health care for farmers.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Otremba, and other testifiers. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? There is nobody else. Any other questions? Go ahead, Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Otremba, excuse me for not being here for the full hearing on this bill. I was called away for a few minutes, but my question would regard farm family, low income, but with assets that disqualify them from Minnesota Care. Is there anything in this bill that will address that, or is there a companion bill coming up also?
Representative O'Trimble.
Well, it probably wouldn't specifically address that unless some of those assets could be depreciated, and the depreciation piece then would be like the Schedule F, which we're not doing now. We're just doing the loss. So only if some of those assets were actually part of something that they could depreciate. But you're right. When Minnesota Care first was established, we didn't count assets. And as we went along, we started to take away things in a lot of areas with Minnesota Care. So then they used my money for something else. So there, I will at some point try to go forward, or backward, I should say, when we were, because it's the working poor, and we want them to have assets. We want them to be in the community and making it. And so I do think that with Minnesota Care, in the initial intent was not to include assets. It was just to become their income. And then it eroded, so to speak. But I think with small business owners and family farmers, we absolutely should go back to not looking at those assets, because they are people in our communities that are paying taxes and taking care of our schools and churches and hospitals. So that's my take on it.
Thank you, Representative Trim. Any other questions?
Follow-up?
No? Any further discussion from anybody? If not, would you please redo your motion, please, Representative Otremba.
I move House File 276 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you very much. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
One point. I had asked for a fiscal note, and even though this isn't finance, it's supposed to come sometime today, and then I'll have it for when we go on to the next finance meeting.
All right. Thank you very much.
Is there any other business or comments or input? If not, the meeting is adjourned.